Coming up on the show, I talk with Elisa McLaughlin, a woman who was diagnosed late in life with autism. We'll talk with her, find out how she went with her life and what she's doing now in her life. So sit back, relax, and I'll see you on the other side. See you there. Hello and welcome to Inside the Asperger Studio Stories. Today on the show, I'm joined with Elisa McLaughlin.
Yeah, not the Lisa, just Elisa.
Diagnosed late in her life with ASD and one hell of a funny woman. Welcome to the show, Elisa.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Reed.
All right, let's start off small. Where were you born?
I was born in Erie, Pennsylvania.
All right. What was life like growing up?
It was complicated. My mother and father divorced when I think I was about 18 months old. So I lived with my mom up until about 1969 or something like that. And then my father gained custody of me and my sister and brother. And that was a totally different environment. Now, they knew that there was something wrong with me from the time I was born. My mother had rubella when she was carrying me. So I was born with blindness in one eye and nerve deafness in one ear. And like most people at that time, they said, oh, she's probably retarded too. I mean, she's just a weird kid or whatever. And then when I was living with my mom, no problem. But when my father gained custody of us, they sent me to special school. This is days before mainstreaming. And after about a year, when I went through second and third grade in one year, they said, no, she's not retarded. She's just a weird kid. We don't know what the deal is. So I then went to a private Catholic school, sister and brother. Unfortunately, the family, and I'm going to skip, I'm going to skip way ahead to about 2 years ago when I finally had the nerve to ask someone who was a very good tarot reader and psychic. I said, why didn't no one, how come nobody ever said anything to me? She goes, they wanted you to be normal. They wanted you to feel normal, so nobody said anything. Okay? So we go back to I'm a little kid. I'm going to Catholic school. And the family just still treated me like I was weird. And so basically I was treated like furniture. They just wouldn't, you know, acknowledge me or anything. And it's both a funny and sad story. My father and his idiot second wife took me to an audiologist because I had poor hearing in my left ear. So they thought maybe the problem's your hearing. So they took me to him and he said, no, you know, I'm sitting in a chair. Here's the audiologist. Here are the parents right in front of me. And he said, well, yeah, she does have nerve deafness. As an adult, she may need hearing aid. It's just fine. And they said, well, we don't understand. Well, that's strange. Why we don't understand why she doesn't acknowledge us when we talk to her. I'm sitting right there in the room. Okay. Mm-hmm. You who? Over here? The person you're, yeah, this is why. Because you ignore me. You treat me like furniture. So I just, you know, and you're stupid, so I just ignored you. And then when you say something to him, you go, we don't understand why she's ignoring us. Because you're boring. And that's why. So that was my whole childhood. Then I moved to San Francisco to join my mother and my sister and brother. And long story, they ended up in San Francisco. I joined them there. And I had precisely one conversation that I can recall with my mother about autism. And I was 19 years old. And there was a film on TV called, I think it was called Sunshine, The Story of a Miracle Child. This kid with severe autism, you know, one of those kids spinning plates and flapping his hands. And I talked to my mom about this movie, I guess. And she said, oh, well, you know, you were autistic as a child, but you outgrew it. And I kind of went, I don't think that's something you outgrow. That was in 1979. If I had been curious, I would have done the research. And I may very well have come upon Laura Wing's research about it, said, oh, here are people who have autistic-like behavior. They have what is called Asperger's, okay? But I didn't, for whatever reasons. So I didn't find out that I was autistic till I was 50.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, for me, when I was diagnosed, there was no such thing as Asperger's back then. Or ADHD. We knew neither of the two. It was learning disabled. So I was put on a medicine that was meant for ADHD people. And it was working wonders until later in life, my parents and my doctor said his medicine will have lasting effects on the liver. My mom's like, I don't want that. So they put me on a non-stimulant, and it's like flipping a switch from being awake in the morning to feeling like I haven't slept all day. And then they put me on Strattera, and that just made me feel spaced out. So I took myself off, and I've been off of it ever since until I went on a – I found this clinical research on Facebook for those who have autism. And it was for a drug that helped work with communications. And it was like the best drug ever. Unfortunately, the company didn't get the results they wanted and pulled the study. But in the process, I made friends with the therapist that ran it, who happens to be the best therapist in the state of Illinois. The top therapist there was. And then he became my therapist and put me on Adderall.
Yeah.
Anyways, back to you. What was your relationship with your parents like?
Well, obviously it was complicated. My mother was always very supportive of my creativity and such, but my father and his family, primarily his parents, these are people very, very ignorant of the subject. I'm guessing that they were probably told, well, you know, the mother had rebellion when she was carrying her. She's probably retarded, so you're going to have to deal with this retarded child. And I wasn't. I was just weird, but they didn't know how to deal with that. So it was very difficult. My father's second wife was, as I said, an idiot. She wasn't fit to raise hamsters, and she had to deal with three children. And so I bore the brunt of a lot of conflict because, you know, it's just like, why aren't you, you know, the old, why aren't you behaving? Why aren't you changing? Blah, blah, blah. Then when I moved to San Francisco, I was just, you know, I was a sullen, brooding teenager who didn't want to have anything to do with anybody, you know, kind of trying to be aloof. And it backfired because they went, okay. And I ended up being ignored again. And I went, well, that didn't work out. So it was a very complicated relationship.
So I'm guessing then your transition from youth to adulthood was a tricky one for you.
I'm sorry, what was it? Transition to what?
From a youth to adulthood.
Oh, God. Yeah. Very, very difficult. Because again, when you become an adult, they say, well, you know, you're 18 or, you know, between 18 and 21. You go, well, you're an adult now. You have to learn how to do this stuff on your own. You don't really get any instruction on how to do that. There actually are a few books out now on how to be an adult. But I'm like, you know.
Like I told one of my friends, I wish there was a manual for life on the spectrum.
Yeah.
Something you can hand over to anybody and go, here, this is how I think, how I operate, how I see life. Use it to your best advantage to understand me.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
Yes. I was at a meeting. This was about 2 years ago, something. And there was a conference for the Autism Society of Oregon. Mm-hmm. I live in Oregon. And they had a meeting, they had some people here, people on the spectrum, and they were talking about transitioning into the work world as a doll and so forth. And each of us gave her a little speech, and then they had a Q&A, which was extraordinarily informative. This woman raised her hand, our moderator said, yes, you have a question? She goes, yes, I'd like to know, very enthusiastic. She said, you know, I want to know if you have, you know, you can help me with finding any support groups or organization to help support my son who's transitioning to an adult. And she said, Corey Turner, and said, there isn't any. And I'll never forget the look on that woman's face. She was just stunned. I mean, well, just shocked. And I went,
yeah,
welcome to the real world, baby. This is what happened. Oh, you're a grown up. You can do it on your own. And this is a huge, huge chasm and it doesn't allow the people. Basically, you know, they'll, you know, throw people in the deep end of the pool. If you swim, fine. If you sink, oh, well. You know, that kind of attitude of you're an adult now, you have to figure it out on your own, sink or swim, you know, survival of the fittest, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, wow, you know, people really hate people with disability. I mean, they claim they like them, but they don't. They don't. There's just nothing there. And I just remember looking at that woman saying, well, this is one of the reasons why I should write this book, to say this is the reality. You know, going from being a kid who has all this attention and they get a special tutor and they're getting all this education and help. And then suddenly, like, you know, shoved out a door in the cold and they close the door, lock it behind you, go, what do I do now? Oh, well, you know, you're an adult. You'll figure it out. Yeah, doesn't work that way. It was very tough. It was a very, very steep learning curve because it was still undiagnosed.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hardest thing as being an adult is... There is no manual of how to be an adult. That's why a good percentage of those on the spectrum mask, so they fit in. And I'm totally against masking because why should I pretend to be something I'm not?
Well, I'm going to modify that. Say there is a kind of masking that the vast majority of people do, and it's like this. Someone who has... It doesn't matter. From their another culture, for instance, and they go, well, we don't do that in our country, so I'm going to mask. I'll pretend to do this custom here to fit in. And so there is a certain degree of masking that's required for people because we all have differences and we all have to make the adjustments. And there's a sort of middle line that everybody, you know, like driving on a road. Well, I could drive all over the map or I could have to drive in this lane with these, you know, the stripes here and the solid. Okay, I get that. And so a lot of people do that. I do agree, though, that unfortunately, because masking can be very difficult for people with ASD because it's a constant thing. We don't have that. We're not like maggots. You throw it in a maggot, sticks. It doesn't stick. So we have to constantly remind ourselves, oh, yeah, don't do that thing. Oh, yeah, don't do that thing. Oh, yeah, that's the way you're supposed to behave. Oh, remember to do this thing. It's just after a while, it just gets exhausting.
Yeah. And that's why you see a lot of kids coming home from school who have ASD go right to their room in the dark, because they are exhausted and they need to bring themselves back down from stimulation overload because their mind is just overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And it's teetering on the effect of a meltdown.
Yeah. And that doesn't end with childhood either. It's adult. No. You come home from whatever you're doing and you just say, you know, I want to be left alone. I just want to just sit here and stare at a blank wall for a while and recoup. And if you have people around you, parents or partners or whatever, understand, they say, okay, that's cool. That's fine. But when people are just like, why you have to be like that? You know what? Up yours. I'm trying to recoup here. Just leave me alone. Okay. And sometimes you just have to be blunt and say, look, you don't understand this. I got to deal with this. There we go. Someone have to call me back later.
Yeah, I understand that because the problem is the world just doesn't understand us. Number one, we act the way we do because our minds can't process the information. I mean, when I was diagnosed with LD, I went away to the University of Oshkosh in Wisconsin. We had this dinner where you get to meet some of the older students. And one of the older students sat me down and said, listen, Reed, I'm going to tell you something. He's like, where it takes a regular student an hour to do their work, it's going to take us 2 hours because it's going to take you an hour to read it and then an hour to process it. And that's how our minds work. We take longer to do our things. We don't have a straight line from A to B. We have a loop-de-loop.
Yeah.
Anyway.
The day that, you know, you said, you know, people just don't understand the way we work. And here's the thing we have to do to people doing advocacy, say, we have to reach out and say, look, this is how we work. We have to help people understand. Oliver Sacks pointed out, he said, Asperger's allows us a window into the world of autism because people with Asperger's can communicate. Since we're standing by the window and we can tell them what's going on over here and communicate with the neurotypical world too. And it's really important that ironically, the we say, oh, you're disabled, you can't handle things. Say, well, it turns out we're the ones that say, no, you're the ones who don't get it. You're the ones that need to be educated. We're fine. We function just fine. You're the ones who have to understand that we do function differently than you. And we have to constantly educate those people and people. So if people just don't understand, say, then we have to help them understand. If they don't understand, well, screw them. It's that simple. You know, you can't say, I'm not going to be, if I can only speak French and I'm working with people with English, I'm going to have to learn some English. But people there can say, since he doesn't know a lot of English, we should learn some French so we can communicate with each other. But it becomes a one way. No, you just can't have, you're in America, speak English. You know, you go, well, you know, how about Americans learning and speak other languages? You go to some other country, the people are multilingual. In America, no. We don't do that. That's basically the attitude of the neurotypical. No, you don't understand. You have to adjust to our world. We don't have to adjust to yours. And think, wow, that's really, first of all, it's discriminatory, but basically it's very limiting. So here's your opportunity to deal with someone who could give you valuable, but the way that you may not expect. And you're just dismissing them because, well, you know, it's like people are dismissed because they're Jewish or black or gay or whatever. Same thing. And the same thing with ASD. They're excused to go, oh, well, you know, you're useless because blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
I mean, the problem with ASD is you'll have families who will look at you and not even acknowledge it's ASD and just say, oh, you're lazy or you're just not motivated enough or you're not driven enough to do this. And my friend kind of has that situation going on. His father is from the old school and his mother and father refused to accept him as being gay. But it's like he had to do his own research on everything about his autism to figure out why he is doing what he's doing. I mean, he literally sat down and did his own research, got himself a therapist, got himself a psychologist, a doctor and everything. But he still can't navigate things like talking to the insurance company, knowing what to ask. I had to help him with that. So it's a crazy world.
Go ahead.
Especially when the world doesn't know how to treat us right. I mean, schools need to be equipped with and trained, especially the teachers, with handling how we are. Knowing that, oh, he is on the spectrum, so we need to have special precautions and special understanding and training how to work with him.
Yeah, that's wonderful, Reid. I love that. That's a beautiful idea. It's never going to work in the real world, and it's not going to work for two reasons. One, it's expensive. Two, society does not want to deal with people who are different. I blame everything on the Industrial Revolution, just so you know. The Industrial Revolution came along and created standardization of things. So we now standardize people too. And this was a perfect reason to standardize people, because we always wanted to. That's the way humans are. So we go, oh, if people are in like this little box, great. If they're not, they're an irregular, they're defective, whatever, throw them out. So again, it's a case of so-called normal people looking at someone, whether they're gay or Jewish or whatever, blah, 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 and saying, okay, they don't fit in this box and we can reject them. And that's what it really boils down to. We said, we don't want to bother with you. You're too much work. Yeah. You know, well, I don't want to understand you. I just want to believe that, you know, society wants gay people to lie. Just pretend you're not gay. Get married, have kids, be the perfect family man there, see, problem solved. And then 20 years into it, he divorces his wife and says, honey, I'm gay. And she flips out, and all the kids flip out, and society rejects her. How could you lie like this? Because you told me you wanted to lie. You told me to lie, and now you're pissed off because I'm telling the truth, because you still want me to lie. I'm not going to do that. And now you're pissed off that I lied, but you go, you wanted me to lie. No, that's not what we wanted you to do. We wanted you to be like everybody else. You know, it's just a very strange logic. And that's the way people think. Your friend, you know, people are in denial about their kids having ASD because they don't want to accept the idea that their kids are different.
Yeah.
Why can't you just be normal like everybody else? Hello, I'm not. It's that simple.
It's a crazy world.
It is a crazy world. And it's a matter of adaptation. There's interesting speculation that people with ASD may in fact be another evolutionary step. That in fact, you know, it's not that there are more people with ASD, maybe there aren't, we're noticing it more. And they said that is an adaptation to a world that's more modern, that's more urban, that's less rural, that relies more on logic and reasoning than intuition and sensing. And this is a response to that. And maybe that's why, you know, that's why people, a lot of people in ASD, they gravitate to things like computer programming and, you know, doing logic and engineering and the radio things. Have you ever read Steve Silberman's book, Neurotribes?
No.
I highly recommend it. A friend of mine recommended me. It's a really great read. And he and community and stuff, how they're very nerdy. And then it was like, wait a second, there seems to be a commonality among these people. And he discovered that that a lot of these people in that area, because of their ASD, they gravitated to those fields. And he made a really interesting comment in an interview he did a while ago. He said, until very recently, meaning the last two decades or so, the conversation about adults with autism has been done behind their backs. You know, we didn't talk about adults with autism. That's things for kids. And all the books, when I first got my diagnosis, that's all I want to read on this. I went to the library, bookstores, all the books are about your child with autism, how to help your child with autism, child, child, child. I found exactly two books that dealt with adults. And only one of them that dealt with adults, females with autism. And it's only recently they're now saying, well, maybe autism is more common with women than we thought. Again, because women are better at masking than guys. And the whole, the gender politics that are involved in that. So autism may simply be a reaction to the environment that we've created. And that's why we're wired the way we are.
All right. Anyways. What motivates you, inspires you, and drives you?
Not a whole lot. I'm one of those people that has the chronic depression. I've had it all my life. And sometimes I have to lie in bed and go, okay, there's a reason for me to get up to bed this morning? Yeah, I don't know what that is. The only thing that really inspires me is my writing, which has gone absolutely nowhere. But that's the only thing that I feel worth doing is writing. And doing some painting, but other than that, no, there's not really not much anything that motivates me. I find the world and life to be extraordinarily disappointing.
All right, what's the best compliment you've ever gotten?
I don't know. I really don't. But people tell me how smart I am. They remark on how intelligent I am. I think that's probably about it.
All right.
Frank King, of course, we were talking about. Frank said he did compliment me being extraordinarily funny, and that he meant that because he's a pro. People always say, "Oh, you're so funny, you should do stand up." Stand up is brutal, but Frank is the one to say, you're one of the funniest people I've met. And I thought, oh, okay, that's a great compliment.
What's your biggest failure and what did you learn from that experience?
I do not think about my failures at all. I do everything my biggest failure is that I've not been a successful writer. And it's something that gives me, it's enormously painful for me. For whatever reasons, I've just not been able to do it. And I, you know, again, I don't know the reason for it. I haven't been able to get anybody who's an editor. I've been thrown out of several writer support groups because they're mostly about ego stroking everybody anyways. And I just have not been able to find a way or someone or a mentor to help me with my writing. So I'm pretty much on my own. That's a big failure.
I'll give you somebody's name at the end of this who's helping me with my book.
Okay.
Tell me about three influential people in your life and how they impacted you.
My best friend, Martha. She is arguably the best friend I've ever had because she's always been very supportive and helpful with me. My mother was very influential, of course. Because she taught me a lot about critical thinking and, you know, how to approach things intelligently. And not necessarily a person, but my training in Aikido has done enormous amount of, has been enormously influential on me. That is the single most calming element that I've had in my life that's helped me to be calmer, to be more focused, to be centered, is the training through martial art of Aikido.
All right. What makes you feel inspired or like your best self?
Either when I'm writing or painting. There's really not much else that really inspires me.
All right. Finish the sentence. I am at my best when?
When I'm writing and everything's working. When I get an idea and I go, oh, that's it, and it flows. When I'm doing something that where there's a, you get into that flow state, that's amazing. It doesn't happen a lot, but when it happens, it's like, yeah, this feels so right. This is what I want. This is just that. Everything's going right.
Okay. If you can turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell her and why?
You have ASD. Learn everything you can about it, because life is going to shit all over you if you don't.
Very true.
I literally, I'd say if I could go up into my past at any time, I'd say, don't. You have to learn about this. You have to learn everything you can about autism. I don't care what you think. Learn everything you can about autism. Read the DSM. That's how I found out I had autism. I was reading the DSM, and I was reading about depression. I was flipping through the pages, and I went, autism, oh, that's a big thing in the news and everything. Let me see what that read. And I read the criteria and said, oh, my God, this is me. And then I read the criteria for Asperger's syndrome, and I get, yes, that's definitely me. And then I found a therapist who specializes in diagnosis, and he said, oh, yeah, you have Asperger's, no doubt about it, just like that.
All right. If you can have a billboard with anything on it, what would it be and why?
There's a joke there, I'm sure. You know, the golden rule. Just follow the golden rule, people. Everybody says they follow the golden rule. They don't. When they say, do unto others, you'd have them do unto you, they really mean, and, you know, Jesus said, love one another. Well, he didn't say, oh, wait a minute, asterisk. I meant was love other people who are like you, and never mind everybody else. You really do have to, we're taught in Aikido, love and help develop, to help us develop all things, have a universal mind that loves and respects all things and helps things grow and develop. And I go, well, I'm having a hard time with that with Mitch McConnell. But other than that, you know, you go, you don't have to like people. You just have to love them. They have as much reason to be here as anybody else. As much as I dislike Rush Limbaugh, he just as much as anybody else. So does a Nazi, so does a supremacist, so does a, you know, blithering idiot. But, you know, they're here for whatever reasons. And I can't fault them, because I said someone could say the same thing about me. So I go, well, I would say just the golden rule, man. That's it.
All right. What do you think the world would look like in 5 years from now?
The way things are going now, we're falling rapidly into environmental collapse.
All right. What was your favorite subject in school?
History.
Would you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
An introvert.
If you could be remembered for one thing, what would it be and why?
I wish it was my writing. But I don't think that's going to happen.
You got to think positive here.
Hope people, you know, I'm not an easy person to get along with. But I'd hope that some people have. I hope some people have some nice things to say about me.
And lastly, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are right now in life?
Well, I think I've explored most of that already. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. Right.
Then we'll go on to the other set of questions which people want to hear. What is your favorite word?
favorite word. I like big clunky words like lugubrious.
What is your least favorite word?
I took a writing class. It was written, it was taught by a published novelist. And you hear this constantly say, don't use was. It's a weak verb. And then, okay. I said, that's going to be tough because I was writing a novel about someone, the first person past tense. So every time I wrote the word was, I would cringe. And then I came to class and she said, well, that wasn't a rule. That was just a suggestion. And I thought, a suggestion? But to this day, I have a very hard time writing the word was when I'm writing stuff because I go, I've been told this is a weak verb. So I go, I got to, then I have to do this runaround. How do I write the sentence without using the word was?
Yeah, we got something in common. I took a writing class, actually, with a published author, too. She was a mystery book writer.
Oh, okay. Well, it's interesting. It's like, this class, she did have some really good advice, and she was a published author. And I said, okay. So after the class was done, I went to the library and I found, I think it was like her first published novel. I said, oh, I'm going to read this. She broke every single effing rule, a suggestion she made in class in that novel. It was horrible. I said, I can't believe this got published. It was bad. It literally broke every rule she talked about. Don't have weak characters.
What do you expect for a first novel?
And I'm just like, pardon?
What do you expect for someone's first novel? They always say your first is your worst.
Yeah, this is true. Okay, I'll cut her some slack for that, but I sincerely hope her other novels are better.
All right. What turned you on creatively, spiritually, and emotionally?
Writing, art, music.
All right. What turns you off?
Pretty much everything else. No. People behaving badly. You know, you see it all. I stopped reading the news. Every morning I get up and I check the email and I read the news. And I went, this is depressing. So I stopped reading the news. I am much happier. I just stopped reading the news. I just go, I don't want to hear about people being stupid every day. Right. I mean, stupid on a colossal scale. People in like just abject, delusional denial. And you just go, you throw up your hands and go, I don't know about these people. That to me is, yeah. The worst.
All right. What is your favorite cuss word?
Fuck.
All right. What sound or noise do you love?
I don't know about noise. I like, I like the sound of wind chimes. Like that. Right. If I really want to be go out there and really be just like super ecstatic, I really listen to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
Okay, what sound or noise do you hate?
Sirens, leaf blowers, and children crying. Leaf blowers are like right up there. As far as I'm concerned, I'm surprised I haven't ice picked or shot somebody with one of those things yet.
All right. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I would really like to be an astronaut.
What profession would you not like to do?
I wouldn't want to be an ad copywriter.
All right. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
I'm sorry. That's a pedantic question. I'll pass. My spiritual beliefs are very personal.
When you arrive in heaven, who would you like to meet?
Again, I'll have to pass. As I said, my spiritual beliefs are private and personal.
And finally, where can people find you on the web?
I have a blog site. It's AMC. Where is that? Oh, it's AMC stubbornturtle.blogspot.com, I believe. Hang on a second. There we go. It's like asking somebody for your own phone number. You go, I don't know. I don't call myself. It is. It's amcstubbornturtle.blogspot.com.
Thank you very much.
And I also have a Facebook page. So.
And that's it. Lisa McLaughlin, comedian, historically funny, and diagnosed late with ASD. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Reed. Appreciate it.
Not a problem.
Can taste it, tell me what you wanna do, and then we're gonna make it happen, cause I'm thinking.